Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Schinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it or downloading it to your iPod or computer or to a disk, whatever you want to, but listen to it when you have time. And today we have an excellent show as we look at the first half of 2010 and see how the courts have handled electronic discovery. What issues are emerging? Are there any trends? What should practicing lawyers be worried of? And what does the future seem to hold? Are questions we'll focus on in this podcast. We have an excellent panel today as we break from past protocol and have two attorneys from the same law firm on the same show. The law firm Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher releases an annual mid-year review of electronic discovery, and while in New York 4 weeks ago, Farrah Pepper and I decided to do this show. However, Farrah is nearing the end of a pregnancy, so I was unsure if we would get the show done before she gives birth, and that's when she told me of another member of her team who's pregnant as well. So we now have the pregnancy exception for any firm which wants to have more than one attorney on ESI Bytes at any time. At the same time, you just both have to be pregnant. So for a final backup, we added Ron Hedges, and there were no tests or anything. Although I Farrah, you look pregnant, and so I'm guessing everything's fine on that regard. But for a final backup, we added Ron Hedges, who's a former magistrate judge and a nationally known electronic discovery consultant, who, in addition to being backup, if one or both of the other panelists go into labor, I've also given Ron the title of the official midwife of ESI Bytes. So
to you, Ron.
Yes, Ron. Yeah. We'll have fun with this at Georgetown this year. I might have a gift for you, Ron. But anyway,
okay.
the first panelist, Farrah Pepper, is of counsel in the New York offices of Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher and practices in the firm's litigation department. Farrah is the vice chair of the firm's Electronic Discovery and Information Law Practice Group. She was the founder and chairperson of the e-discovery task force at Gibson Dunn that was formed in 2006 and recently converted into the Electronic Discovery and Information Law Practice Group earlier this year. She is also a member of the Crisis Management and White Collar Defense and Investigations Practice Groups. Farrah's litigation practice is dedicated to electronic discovery and information law issues, with a focus on providing cost-effective and defensible strategies and solutions in these areas to her clients. Her practice spans a wide breadth of client industries and substantive areas of law, with a particular emphasis on complex civil litigation and regulatory, white-collar, criminal, and internal investigations. Farrah frequently publishes and speaks on topics of electronic discovery and information law. In addition, she regularly provides training sessions on electronic discovery and information law within the firm and to client audiences. She's also a member of various industry organizations, including the Sedona Conference Working Group 1 on Electronic Document Retention and Production, Sedona Conference Working Group 6 on International Electronic Information Management, Discovery, and Disclosure, and the American Bar Association Committee on e-Discovery and Digital Evidence, ARMA International, the New York State Bar Association Committee on Electronic Discovery, and the New York Chapter of Women in E-Discovery. Farrah, welcome to have you. Glad to have you on the show here.
Thanks so much, Carl. Happy to be here.
Thanks. And the second panelist is Jennifer Reardon, a partner resident in Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher's New York office, who is a member of the firm's litigation department and co-chair of the firm's Electronic Discovery and Information Law Practice Group. Jennifer's practice focuses on class actions and other complex business litigation at the trial level, including securities fraud, accountant malpractice, and hostile M&A, as well as appeals. She's a frequent author and speaker on securities law and electronic discovery topics. Glad to have you on, Jennifer. And Ron, our third panelist, is a four-time presenter on ESI Bytes, and while he may not catch Judge Grimm, he can hold on to this unique title of ESI Bytes midwife. Ron has served as a United States Magistrate Judge in the District of New Jersey from 1986 to 2007. He's a member of the Sedona Conference Advisory Board and participates in Sedona working groups on e-discovery and records, international e-discovery, and confidentiality public access. Ron's also a member of the advisory boards of the Advanced e-Discovery and Corporate Counsel Institutes of Georgetown University Law Center, where he teaches e-discovery and evidence as an adjunct faculty member. among his many other publications. He's the author of Discovery of Electronically Stored Information, Surveying the Legal Landscape from BNA in 2007, and a co-author of Managing Discovery of Electronic Information, A Pocket Guide for Judges, through the Federal Judicial Center in 2007. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. And first of all, Farah and Jennifer, congratulations. And being e-discovery lawyers in New York City, maybe you'll consider the following names, Laura Zubelake Pepper and Shira Shinlin Reardon. You both have girls. I think that'd be great. And, you know, and since Ron's been on the show a number of times, I'd like to ask both of you how you got interested in electronic discovery. Farah, why don't we start with you?
Well, thanks, Carl. You know, first and foremost, let me say that Jennifer and I have heard the calls out there that there's a shortage of qualified e-discovery practitioners. And so we're doing our part to bring more into the world. So I hope the community appreciates the length we'll go to make sure there are qualified practitioners out there.
May you have twins or triplets.
Well, you know, e-discovery for me, you know, it really appeals to my personality type. And I got introduced to it as a very junior associate at Gibson Dunn. The nature of the cases I was working on really made it obvious to me that this was a topic that was a coming tsunami that not everyone was prepared for. And particularly for our serial litigant clients, it was very much on their radar, and they were turning to us for guidance. And so it became clear early on that we had a need as a firm to have an action plan in place for e-discovery, which was what led us in 2006 to form our task force in e-discovery. It was interdisciplinary. It had attorneys at every level of seniority, litigation support professionals, paralegals. And, you know, over time, the importance and complexity of e-discovery just grew and grew and grew. So in January of this year, we turned that task force into a formal practice group. And so, you know, just a few of the things that I love about this area, and it basically had me at hello, was, you know, it's team-based work, but it's definitely something that requires you to have a strong investigative bent. You know, you have to play Sherlock Holmes and get to the bottom of things. You know, it's the challenge of taking chaos, and you have to make order out of it. And there's this really fascinating interplay between technology and society and how dramatically technology impacts the way we live, the way we work. And on a purely intellectual level, I love that you have to take the existing legal principles and apply them to new areas of technology. And beyond that, grapple with what changes in the law are necessary to fit this brave new world. So put all that together, and I was a goner, hook, line, and sinker as soon as I fell into this area.
Great. And why don't we, Jennifer, how about yourself?
Well, a number of years ago, I found myself in the middle of a couple of very large litigations that had significant electronic discovery components. And I realized then, despite what some of our colleagues might think or might have thought at the time, and unfortunately might still think, hopefully not, that component can be absolutely central to a litigation. It is given all kinds of attention by the courts, and I realize the trouble that parties can get into if they don't pay serious attention to the electronic discovery aspects of the matter and learn as much as they can about it and know what they're doing. And since then, it's only been true that increasing number of cases have had large electronic discovery components, and indeed it's almost hard to find a case these days for people who practice in large law firms. It's difficult to find a case that doesn't have some electronic discovery component to it, and so this area has only taken on more and more importance over the years. I found myself in the middle of it. I really enjoyed it. I saw how critical it was to the success of a case. And one thing I love about it is that it requires the constant exercise of judgment, because cases in this area, to this point anyway, have largely relied on reasonableness tests and ad hoc factual inquiries. And so there's only been so much guidance out there. And if you work in this area, you have to constantly be doing this kind of analysis in your head and hashing it out with your colleagues, figuring it out with your clients, and you have to exercise judgment because there's been only so much to go on. Now, as we addressed in our mid-year report, and as I think we're going to talk about more today, things may be changing. I mean, courts are churning out law in this area every day, and so the guidance has gotten a little bit better and a little bit more clear.
Well, let's jump right into that. The survey, which Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher's just released, you do a mid-year and then you do end-of-year what's happened in case law, and it's available at the firm's website for free, so I'd encourage everyone to download it. But first of all, Farah, tell us about the survey and how did you pick the 103 cases you evaluated?
Well, the survey is something that we're now in the second year of doing. We started last year with the 2009 mid-year report and then did a year-end as well. And we got great feedback from that, so we decided to continue with the project. And our goal with the project was to take a scholarly approach and provide an overview of what was happening in the courts and then draw up our analysis of the trends from there. So we did what lawyers often do best, which is roll up our sleeves and dive into the case law and pull together all the cases we could find and analyze those results. We didn't want to issue something where we just pontificated about what the future might hold. We wanted to make sure our report was really grounded in the current state of the law. So to do that, our final report, which is very much a group effort, it reflects the contributions from 15 of our attorneys in our e-discovery practice group. It reflects independent research that was done. We strove to be as comprehensive as possible. And we also reviewed various sources out there in the industry that compile e-discovery cases. And so we supplemented our independent research with double checks on various websites and databases that are available out there in the world, you know, the BNAs of the world and other sources that do a good job of pulling this information together. And so put that all together, and we get 103 cases, and we hope that we captured everything, and we intended to. And, you know, the criteria that we used essentially was any case that had a significant e-discovery component to it. And given the positive feedback we've been getting, we absolutely plan to continue issuing this on a mid-year and an annual basis.
Okay, so maybe we'll have you back in 6 months. Well, Ron, why don't we just start jumping into the survey, and we'll look at different sections. And let's start with sanctions, because that's what every e-discovery lawyer either fears or is hoping for, depending on how they're being impacted. What does the survey tell us about sanctions and the way case law is developing?
Well, frankly, I think it tells us that there are a lot of different opinions all over the place. And if you're particularly worried as an attorney that you could be sanctioned, the case law doesn't give you any solace. And I don't honestly see any trends coming out of the case law that are going to be of any guidance to attorneys other than these. You know, when you read Pension Committee, which Judge Schindler wrote, and you read Rimkus Consulting, which Judge Lee Rosenthal wrote in Texas, you see that there's an issue of scienter that needs to be addressed. And there is some variance around the country among the federal courts as to what showing of intent is necessary for sanctions. So to that extent, the state of mind of an attorney, if it is relevant, is going to be very dependent on the court where the proceeding is sitting or whichever law applies. I think something else you see that is the end of a very sad saga that's been going on for a couple of years now in Qualcomm is the magistrate judge in the last decision in March, I believe, found faults both with outside counsel and corporate attorneys and corporate representatives. And I think it's fair to say that that represents a concern that attorneys need to have if they're working with clients, or for that matter with consultants, and who is responsible for what and what type of due diligence, for lack of a better word, outside counsel needs to have when they're trying to get discovery from their client to turn over to the other side. So I think there's a very mixed bag this year. There's a big question about scienter. Certainly Qualcomm, although it does end that saga, hopefully, presents the specter of problems between client and attorney and what type of impact that's going to have. And I think the other thing that you might be seeing that maybe is a trend is that courts are looking for some type of affirmative conduct or affirmative misconduct, if you will, as a general proposition, for sanctions are imposed on attorneys. Can lawyers be held strictly liable for failure to produce and the like, sure they can. But, you know, judges generally don't wake up every morning and tell themselves, who do I get to sanction today? So I think there's a mixed bag this year. We really don't have circuit guidance in the e-discovery area, although obviously courts have looked at sanctions imposed on parties and the like, if not on lawyers. And I expect we're going to see this developing over the next year or so.
One little follow-up here, and Farrah or Jennifer, if you want to chime in as well, welcome to do that. The thing that gets, I think, attorneys' attention quite a bit is the sanctions on themselves. And Ralph Losey did a little analysis of the survey and put up a chart that it was 10% of the sanction cases that were in the survey were sanctions involving attorneys. So what are cases and facts which occur to create this type of outcome?
One thing, obviously, is affirmative misconduct by a lawyer, where an attorney is seen hiding the ball, if you will, in discovery. And that certainly seems to me to be a no-brainer. If you can demonstrate that type of conduct, that attorney should be sanctioned. And frankly, that attorney has ethical problems, because that's a violation of the rules of professional conduct. In addition to that, I think you can also see developing a pattern of where a client is doing something, an attorney is just signing off on it without really knowing what's going on. And that's Rule 26G of the federal rules. And we had a decision that Judge Grimm wrote a year or so ago that talks about the consequences of 26G. So I think it's fair to say courts are looking to the effect of signatures. When lawyers affirm things, courts expect those to be accurate. Maybe not totally correct, but at least accurate based on the knowledge they have after some type of reasonable investigation was done.
Okay. Farrah or Jennifer, I don't care who answered this, I'll throw this out to both of you. Do you see an intersection between the trends in sanctions and cooperation?
We do, actually, and we urge people when they consider the sanctions decisions that are out there to also be thinking about the flip side of the cooperation cases that are out there. For those who may not already be initiated, the Sedona Conference issued its cooperation proclamation over a year ago, and that's a call to arms for legal practitioners to act cooperatively when trying to resolve discovery issues. And one trend that we did see that was a continuation of a trend we saw last year was that increasingly judges will cite to the cooperation proclamation when chiding counsel for not acting cooperatively before bringing disputes into the court. And so one thing that we're seeing is that courts are urging, and in some cases slapping the wrists of attorneys who are not engaging in cooperation, which is an obligation that they have pursuant to 26F anyway, and is only enhanced by the cooperation proclamation itself. Of course, it doesn't have the binding effect of law, but it does have a long list of signatory judges who take it quite seriously and who are citing it in their courtroom. And so it's at the peril of those counsel who refuse to cooperate and then march into courtrooms touting all sorts of discovery issues. They shouldn't be entirely surprised if judges are then frustrated and have sanctions in store, you know, not case-ending ones perhaps, but smaller-level sanctions that urge people along the path of proper meet-and-confer-style cooperation.
Let's talk a little bit about failure to preserve sanctions. It appears the big issue here is the level of culpability required to get sanctions awarded is now split between courts. Ron, you talked a little bit about this a few minutes ago, but if you wanted to talk a little bit about that. And as a follow-up question, I know the Pension Committee has been well covered online and in blogs and in other ESI Bytes podcasts, but why don't you touch upon the need for written hold instructions?
Well, let's talk a little bit about the level of culpability or scienter. As you read the decisions I mentioned before, Pension Committee and Rimkus, you're going to see different approaches taken by different district judges to the question of the level of scienter that's required. I think it's fair to say in the Second Circuit, or at least in the Southern District of New York, for the imposition of serious sanctions, not case-terminating sanctions, but close to it where you have an adverse inference, or at least that's what a lot of people think an adverse inference instruction is. Negligence is enough. Gross negligence is certainly enough. And willfulness obviously is enough. In the Fifth Circuit, in Judge Rosenthal's circuit, there's a degree of willfulness that's required. So you certainly have that distinction. There is pre-e-discovery case law in most places that addresses the question of culpability. Judge Rosenthal's opinion canvasses the circuits on where they stand on culpability. My old circuit is the Third Circuit, and there is a recent decision that came out of New Jersey questioning the degree of scienter necessary to impose serious sanctions on a party. So there's a lot to talk about there. As I mentioned earlier, it's very jurisdiction-specific. And going on to the other question about the holds, and I know that Judge Shindlin's decision in Pension Committee certainly has been the subject of any one of a number of programs. I think it's fair to say that as you read the decision, if she doesn't come out and say failure to have a written hold is negligence, she certainly seems to suggest it. And my recollection is, for those of you who are listening who may not know this, is that there was a revised opinion issued shortly after the original decision was issued, perhaps a few days later or a day. And more recently, there was another decision issued that talked about the consequences of failure to, as I recall, impose a written hold. I think it's fair to say that it's a little difficult to have an off-the-board or across-the-board decision as to whether failure to issue a written hold would be negligence or not. If you're, for example, in a closely held company, Carl, and there are three people in the organization for some reason, you have to wonder whether under those facts, failure to issue a written hold would be negligence at all if someone could document that on such and such a day, I spoke to my fellows and told them to do X, or the attorney could document on such and such a day, I met with three people in their office and told them what they need to do. So is there a concern if you fail to issue a written hold, you're at least negligent? Yes. I think it's going to turn out as we go forward to be very fact-dependent.
And I've been a sole proprietor before, and I sometimes write memos to myself on things to do, but anyway.
Well, you know, there's going to be a spectrum. If you're in a large organization and you have, for example, 60 or 70 people who are subject to a hold, I think you could easily make the argument there that if a written hold isn't issued, it's negligent because it's very likely that everyone is not going to get it. But if you're in a small organization like yours, or you've got two or three people involved, then the question is it reasonable to issue a written hold under those circumstances? And I don't know that it is.
All right, Farah, there was one interesting case I noticed in a survey involving failure to preserve a thumb drive in Wilson v. Thorne Energy. Yeah, if you want to talk a little bit about the facts of that case.
Sure thing, Carl. Well, that's courtesy of Judge Moss in the Southern District of New York. And the facts in that case were as follows. There were plaintiffs who made a loan to the defendants to transfer petroleum blocks in Liberia to an oil company. And the plaintiff sought an accounting and said that the defendants failed to honor a promissory note in connection with that transaction. The defendants said, sure, we'll provide a full accounting, but then a six-month delay went by, and they still had failed to produce sufficient documents for plaintiffs to understand what happened to their money. And the defendants started claiming that a computer failure had resulted in the loss of a lot of documents. There was a 30B6 deposition that followed of defendant's records custodian, and that custodian said that the relevant documents had been stored on a USB flash drive, the flash drive had failed, and that her attempts to restore it were unsuccessful. After that, she said she discarded the drive. And in response to questions about the bank record, she said she'd get started working on them. So the court took a look at all of this and said, well, look, the defendant's duty to preserve documents arose well before this flash drive allegedly failed, and it wasn't a burden on plaintiffs to establish that the defendants had intentionally destroyed the drive. It was enough to just show that they were negligent. And the court said that the failure to collect documents from the custodian, a key witness, in a timely fashion was, in fact, gross negligence or willfulness, and cited pension committee in this discussion. And another interesting wrinkle in this case is that the safe harbor of Rule 37E was brought up. Defendants would have liked some protection from 37E for this flash drive that failed because they said they didn't do anything to make that happen. It just happened. And the court said that the documents on the flash drive, you know, it wasn't lost because of some standard routine practice of the flash drive or a computer system, but rather the documents got lost because the defendants had failed to make a copy before the flash drive failed. And this happened after they had a preservation obligation. And so, therefore, 37E was held not to apply in this situation. And the court, said that because the records management custodian had said that she was going to start working on the accounting after her deposition, the court reasoned that there were obviously some documents that they could have relied upon. And so, you know, everything that they were getting was just excuses that they were not willing to accept. And so in the end, what the plaintiffs sought and got was an order that found the defendants in contempt and awarded sanctions for failure to comply with discovery orders. And in the end, there was evidentiary preclusion because no evidence could be offered about the financial records or the data that was allegedly contained on that flash drive. So it's a very short opinion, but chock full of interesting issues.
Yes, just some... lots of reasons why you shouldn't put corporate records only on thumb drives.
That's right.
Well, the preservation obligations that are now being pointed at, which you referred to in the surveys, outlier ESI, I thought these were interesting cases. And you want to talk a little bit about that area a little bit more, Farah?
Absolutely. Well, outlier ESI is one of those phrases that we actually coined over here because we thought that it nicely captured the idea that there's the basic ESI that everybody knows about these days, you know, your emails and documents that might exist in Word or Excel. And then there are the outliers, and those are the things that might be a little more on the periphery, and so people just aren't as comfortable dealing with them, and they might be out of sight and out of mind, and therefore not the first thing that people think about when they think about their ESI obligations when it comes to preservation and production. So things that we consider to be examples of outlier ESI would be data on cell phones or PDAs, voicemail systems, IM systems, chat rooms, websites, and then social media sites, collaborative tools, and depending how broadly you define it, even that flash drive that we just talked about in the Wilson case. So we identified a number of cases where already in the first half of this year, there has been some analysis of the duty to preserve various types of outlier ESI. There was one case where there was discussion of the duty to preserve instant messages, another about preserving Skype messages, and yet another, the one we just talked about flash drives, the Wilson case. And, you know, what we think is interesting about that is that outlier ESI, there traditionally hasn't been a whole lot of case law addressing those types of media. And we're seeing even in the first half of this year, a handful of them already do. So this may be one of those areas that's ripe for more attention and more guidance in the coming year.
Boy, with all the battle, smartphones and droids and iPhones, you just can't. It's a safe bet to say that outlier is more flexible for people. So obviously there's going to be more and more ESI there. So, well, that's good stuff. A nice phrase.
Well, thank you.
Okay. I'd like to move into an area that I particularly enjoy, which is search and retrieval, since that's where I work. And Jennifer, what did your survey reveal about search and retrieval law in the first half of 2010?
Well, I enjoy that area as well, Carl, and our survey revealed a couple of trends in this area. The first development we uncovered is that there's a question emerging about the extent to which courts are willing to get into the weeds when it comes to search methodology. And we've got, from the first 6 months of this year, courts at either end of the continuum on that question. At one end, the Seeger case out of the District of Nebraska denied a motion to compel where the defendant failed to show relevance of information sought by its proposed search terms. Now, there were 24 search terms at issue in this case, and the court looked at all of them. That's a pretty low-level examination by a judge. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, we have some courts indicating that they're kind of uncomfortable getting into the weeds to that extent. There's the Urand case out of the District of Delaware, where the court actually said that it was not going to enter into the wilderness, it used that word, the wilderness of keyword search usage, and it declined to direct the search terms that the plaintiffs would employ in that case. This sort of harkens back to a decision from last year that actually Farah and I previously wrote about. It was the Gross Construction Associates case decided by Magistrate Judge Peck here in the Southern District of New York. And in that case, the material at issue was that of a non-party. And the non-party and both parties to the action ended up in a fight about search terms. And the non-party, which the judge thought was in the best position to provide clarity to the court about what search terms would be appropriate and, you know, what sort of volume and substance they would yield. Unfortunately, the non-party there only weighed in to the extent of saying, you know, I think the one side's proposal about the search terms we should use is too narrow, and the other side's proposal seems to be overly broad. And the judge ended up saying, you know, this puts me in an uncomfortable position. You know, the judge clearly did not want to have to craft the search terms for the parties, but ended up looking at that issue a lot more closely than it seems like he was hoping he would have to. So we continue to have a division there, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays out in the coming months and years.
I agree. You know, we're going to be doing a number of podcasts in this area coming up. I have one podcast set up with a couple of lawyers focusing on what do you get with search terms if you can even get an agreement. And I'm trying to put together something with some judges who I'm going to actually give some demos on concept searching to get a few judges into the weeds so that they can begin talking a little bit about that area. But it is a real challenge because who wants to be a document reviewer?
Well, It is a challenge, but one thing people can keep in mind, and this is another trend that's emerged in this area in the past few months, is that the cooperation theme that we've already hit on a couple of times today, it certainly seems to permeate any number of e-discovery cases, and the search methodology area is no exception. And this is exemplified recently by a case out of the Northern District of Georgia, a Campbell Soup case, where parties responding to discovery had made numerous attempts to meet and confer, according to the court, and the court ended up sanctioning a requesting party who had refused to, in the court's view, reasonably narrow the document requests by means of specific search terms or to place limits on the number of custodians whose files needed to be searched. So, you know, as we continue to grapple with this question of what's the best way to go about approaching search methodology and what is the court that I'm in going to do? Is the court going to really dive in and look at 24 different search terms, or is the court going to say, you know, this is really not where I want to be? One thing for people to remember is that this is another area where cooperation is expected, I think the cases are showing, and can be very helpful.
Ron, as a general proposition, just to close out this area, do you think that courts are comfortable assessing search term efficiency yet? I mean, how many judges have done document review work? It's really like lifting up a rock on electronic discovery process instead of grappling with a legal issue. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think, number one, judges have not, as a general proposition, done this as attorneys, I would think. As we're going forward and we have new generations of judges coming in out of law firms, some of them will have. But one of the concerns I've had in this entire area, Carl, is that what is going to be happening, and if you read the O'Keefe decision by Judge Facciola from the District of Columbia written several years ago, he's suggesting that we really need to bring expert testimony into the area. And if you read Victor Stanley, that was written by Judge Grimm, he says the same thing. And I think that goes back to what my co-presenters just said, that this is really an area to try to get cooperation as to search terms, assuming you're even using search technology to find keywords or the like, or in any other technology, because I don't think parties really want to spend the time and effort to go through experts to get Daubert opinions and the like in, so a judge can have a hearing and do this. And this really threatens, I think, to derail litigation in what we call satellite discovery. So I have to echo the idea that this is an area to work something out with the other side if you can. And if you decide to do it yourself, I really think that it behooves a party to be very transparent into what search terms it's picked and the like, instead of just presenting a universe of documents to the other side and say, here's everything, we've been reasonable, believe us, and go from there.
Now this next area has been set up perfectly, since everyone seems to want to jump into the area of cooperation. It's one of the great buzzwords from 2009. In fact, I was at a firm giving them sort of an overview to about 12 lawyers on e-discovery, and I handed out the lyrics to Kumbaya before I began teaching this area. Then I said it's actually very serious, and I don't want you to think it's that, because there's substantive advantages to cooperating, and because that's, I think, what people, litigators typically think when you talk about cooperating. But Jennifer, there seems to be growing attention on this concept from courts, and you want to elaborate from your mid-year summary?
Sure. Well, as Farah alluded to earlier, we've seen a continuation in the trend of courts explicitly referencing the Sedona Conference Cooperation Proclamation in the past few months. We saw this trend begin last year, but by the end of 2009, the Cooperation Proclamation had been endorsed by more than 100 judges in federal districts nationwide, and that's only continued into 2010. And we have four cases out of the last 6 months where judges have expressly reference the Cooperation Proclamation and have urged reliance on it. Everything from cases out of the District of Colorado and the District of Kansas, where judges ended up saying, read it, please, and work together consistent with it on the one hand. And we have a couple of other cases in which the judges work the Cooperation Proclamation into their analysis. For example, the District of Colorado, in the Home Design Services case, where the magistrate judge quoted heavily from the Cooperation Proclamation and said that counsel bear a professional responsibility, including in connection with the issues that are before me, to conduct discovery in a diligent and candid manner. So we've seen a continuation of that trend. Another trend in the cooperation area is for courts not to expressly reference the Cooperation Proclamation, but to urge cooperation anyway. And we've got a couple of cases demonstrating that, one out of the Western District of Pennsylvania and the other out of the Southern District of Ohio. Both of them concerned search methodology, and the courts directed the parties to meet and confer further on the scope of the request and the search terms to be used. So that is going on as well. And, of course, the obligation and the expectation that counsel would cooperate on these matters predates the Cooperation Proclamation, but the Cooperation Proclamation seems to have reinvigorated this and, breathed new life into the idea and encouraged courts to cite it more regularly, or at least to seem to have it on their minds more regularly even than before. And another trend in the cooperation area relates to disputes over the form of production of ESI. And courts are coming out differently on the question of native format and the extent to which parties need to produce in native format. We've got one case out of the Eastern District of Missouri, where a motion to compel production of certain drawings, engineering drawings in Native format, was denied because Native production was not specified in the request. And then on the other hand, we've got a case out of the District of D.C., this is the Magistrate Judge Fatiola again, where the motion to compel was granted and Native format was ordered to be provided when the documents at issue were spreadsheets and emails that initially counsel had only provided in, I think, a PDF format, which is, of course, is not very useful to anybody because it's frozen. So the uncertainty out of the courts at this moment about form of production questions suggests that this is an area where reaching agreement is really worth considering. That's basically what we've seen in the first few months of the year in this area.
Okay, now let's move to proportionality cases. And Ron, do you detect the theme from the cases cited in the survey that outside consultants are real important to support proportionality arguments?
Well, to the extent you're asking a court to make some kind of value judgment based on representations as to expense and the like, sure, I think you need affidavits from people who know what they're talking about. I would be very leery, for example, of having an attorney at a firm file an affidavit that says X, Y, and Z, because quite frankly, that turns the attorney into a possible witness at a deposition if the court decides to allow discovery in the area. So I think you may see an area here where you need consultants at least to come in and talk about the cost that that's going to be incurred in doing something, or the delay that might be with it, or the like. And this goes back to the O'Keefe opinion by Judge Fatiola, where he says, look, you know, lawyers and judges, we're all lay people in this. We need help, and we're going to get help from some type of an expert. And that brings you back potentially, although I don't think this is a Daubert question, it brings you back in an area where you may have dueling affidavits or the like from experts, and you may wind up going down the road of discovery. Just as you might, for example, Carl, if there was an argument about whether certain information is not reasonably accessible.
Okay. Jennifer, let's talk a little bit about Rule 502. The survey talks about some decisions in that area and some cases that have addressed Rule 502 and the waiver of privilege. You want to talk a little bit about this area and what's going on?
Sure. Well, what we're seeing so far in 2010, I think as we would expect, is that courts are continuing to flesh out the interpretation of 502B. And just to back up there for a second, the elements that you need to satisfy 502B, which provides that disclosure of privileged or protected material is not a waiver under certain circumstances, and those would be if the disclosure is inadvertent, and second, if the holder of the privilege or protection took reasonable steps to prevent the disclosure, and furthermore, upon discovery, the holder promptly took reasonable steps to rectify the error. And this year, the specific question that seems to be working its way through the courts has been, has concerned the definition of reasonable steps. And I think we're going to have a little bit of discussion of the case law in a second. But in terms of that, one difficulty with 502B is that it uses that inherently uncertain subjective reasonableness language. And for that reason, 502B only gets you so far. I mean, you can take only so much comfort in it. And one thing that we think it makes sense to keep in mind is for people to not lose sight of 502D, which is a very handy tool. That provision, of course, provides that a federal court can enter a protective order stating that disclosure of privileged information will not constitute a waiver, and that order would be enforceable against any persons or entities in any federal, state, or state proceeding. And so 502D gives a mechanism to claw back protected information without people having to worry about getting into a fight over what reasonableness or reasonable steps means under 502B.
Okay, and Ron, I don't know if you want to add anything to that area. I know you had some thoughts.
Well, when 502 was enacted, it was made very clear in the statement of legislative history that was adopted by the House that there was not going to be any type of uniformity and standard as to what reasonableness meant. And the consequences, I think it's fair to say, what we're seeing from the case law is that the district courts are adopting, generally speaking, pre-existing law on waiver that the courts had had and putting them into defining what reasonableness is. So one of the concerns I think that I've had about 502 is that although it's intended to help you create some uniformity, especially for firms that have national practice, such as the Gibson Dunn folks here, and it's very hard to do that because there is no uniformity around the country.
Interesting. Okay.
So that's an area I think I think people should be concerned about, at least until we see some circuit guidance coming out. And my suggestion would be, frankly, that the courts of appeal are going to be doing the same thing that the district courts are doing. They're going to be adopting their pre-existing case law.
Okay, well, that'll give you a lot to write about for the next coming years, I imagine, at Gibson
yes.
Dunn. So anyway, all right, well, no shortage of things to write about or to podcast about is what I can say. But anyway, well, back to the survey. There were a number of privacy cases decided in the first half of 2010. Kwan and the Supreme Court's limited analysis in this area has already been covered quite a bit elsewhere, including an ESI Bytes podcast with Ed McNicholas. But there was a New Jersey decision in Stengart versus Loving Care Agency. And Ron, since you're from the Garden State, would you care to discuss this case?
Sure. Ms. Stengart worked for the Loving Care Agency. She became dissatisfied with either working conditions or the like at her employer and began to email her attorney about it. And it was being done through Yahoo, I believe, but over the corporate system. And not surprisingly, Ms. Stengart winds up in litigation with her former employer. And in answers to interrogatories, the former employer produces some of the email that Stengart had sent to her counsel, which led to a demand by plaintiff's counsel, Ms. Stengart's counsel, to have the documents returned, disputes as to whether there had been a waiver of privilege or the like because of the nature of the communications, and finally the New Jersey Supreme Court saying Stengart did not know the email was being archived in her employer's systems. It was password protected. She took reasonable steps to protect against waiver. And the Supreme Court, among other things, remanded to the trial court to decide whether or not the defendant's counsel should be disqualified because there was a violation of the ethical rules in New Jersey by the attorneys taking something that on its face was privileged and reading it and using it in litigation. So I think it's almost more of an ethics question. Although it does talk again about reasonableness, what type of steps need to be taken to avoid waiver of privilege. Other interesting thing that the opinion says is, you know, we're going to, as a matter of public policy, say that whenever you communicate with an attorney through some type of protected mechanism, it is never going to be something that employer is going to be able to get. Although the court did encourage employers to create communications policy, so there were some clear guidelines as to what an employee could or could not do.
I'm almost wondering if we're going to see more and more cases like this in your coming surveys where state courts are beginning to really jump in with important decisions. Is this, you think, a precursor of more state opinions coming out?
Well, I think it's going to have to. And if you look at Stengart itself to some extent relied on or cited to an opinion from the New York Court of Appeals, more or less on the same issue. You've got Kwan now that basically talks about the rights of public employees. You have Stengart and decisions like it to talk about the rights of private employees. And for that latter, I think a lot of case law is going to be made at the state level because a lot of the employer-employee rights we're talking about are still governed by common law.
Okay.
So until a legislature jumps in and does something, as perhaps has been done by some statutes at the federal level, the states are going to have a major play in this area. And certainly they're going to have a major play in the ethical obligations of attorneys when the attorneys look at communications such as the ones in issue in Stengart.
I'm doing a podcast next week where I'm comparing New York state law versus Second Circuit and federal law, just because I think you're going to see more and more state, more and more sort of opportunities for people to consider going to state court versus federal.
Oh, I don't think that's going to be a question at all as we go forward.
So
you're going to see, I think, a relatively big change in the law at the federal and state level as to what can and can't be done. And I think that if you compare Kwan and Stengart, you're going to see that there are very different approaches to what it means to be reasonable.
Yep. Well, the last area I'd like to talk about is a real interesting area. We could do and will do a whole show on this, I'm sure, at some point. Again, is the social media cases, which the survey shows are now hitting the courts. Farah, care to talk a little bit about these cases?
Sure thing. Well, social media is definitely the buzzword of the moment right now. I don't know if we have any other Zoolander fans out there, but as that movie likes to say, it's so hot right now.
Mm-hmm.
And what's going on with those cases is we're seeing regularly that social media data is being introduced as evidence in cases. And so there's no shortage of examples, even from the first half of this year, of social media data being used in an evidentiary fashion. Just one example is in a case that the issue was whether there was a lack of parental supervision. The evidence that was introduced was a child's use of inappropriate language on Facebook after midnight. And so it's opened up all sorts of interesting new forms of evidence that are being used in cases. From the e-discovery perspective, what we haven't seen yet and what we're still eagerly awaiting is guidance from the courts in terms of what the preservation and production obligations are, separate and apart from any evidentiary value that this information might have. So that is an area where we absolutely think that we're going to see movement, and we are keeping an eye out for it, because until there's guidance from the courts, this is something that is very much up in the air for the moment.
It's such a hard technical area to even figure out what to do. It'll be interesting to see what courts do with this area. I know everyone's waiting and watching.
Absolutely.
It's a good area for cooperation, huh?
Absolutely. It all comes together.
Okay. Well, in conclusion, I'll give each of you a cut at what do you think the future holds for the second half of 2010, given what the first half has shown us? And, why don't we go Jennifer, Farah, and then Ron?
Well, I'm very eager to see what happens, as I mentioned before, in the search methodology area, because we have some courts willing to delve right into that and others who seem to want to stay a bit of a distance and expect greater cooperation from parties in this area. So I think the jury is still out on that, and we'll see if we get any more decisions on this subject between now and the end of the year. I think that it will be interesting to see, and that courts will begin to grapple with Kwan and the questions that the Supreme Court did not resolve in that opinion as they continue to emerge in employee privacy matters. And finally, I think we may see increasing impatience on the part of judges with people who are not getting it, not understanding the importance of electronic discovery issues in litigation, and the fact that this is a brave new world that all of us who practice in this area, or at least practice in at the trial level, need to be understanding and working through with counsel for other parties. I mean, we saw impatience on the part of Judge Shindlin in the recent pension committee decision. You know, it's been 6 years. People don't seem to have learned what I was saying all those years ago, and we're still dealing with issues relating to failures to preserve and lack of cooperation. So I think we're going to, as time goes on, only see more and more of this from judges, where they're saying essentially, come on, folks, you know, let's get with it. It's 2010. This is not brand new anymore.
Okay. Farrah, you want to add anything to that?
Absolutely. You know, in addition to everything that Jennifer noted, I think that we can expect, as we saw in the first half of this year, that courts are going to continue to confront more nuanced e-discovery issues as the practitioners and the clients continue to become a little more sophisticated about these issues. We hope for further guidance in a number of areas. We just mentioned social media as one of them. But we also hope for more guidance in terms of outlier ESI. And one area we didn't have a chance to talk about today, which we covered in the report, is the tension between the very liberal U.S. discovery rules and foreign blocking statutes and privacy law. That seems to be an area that's ripe for further guidance from the courts, because as of right now, still not very clear where we stand, and it can be a perilous landscape out there when you're trying to figure out what's safe to do. Beyond that, I think for the rest of 2010, on behalf of Jennifer and myself, I think we're anticipating a lot of round-the-clock feedings and dirty diapers.
Okay. Ron, I don't know how you top that, but go ahead.
I don't know what else there is to say, but I try. Building on some things that were said before, I would expect as we go forward in the year, we're going to start seeing case law developing on social media. I don't know if we're going to see it in 2010, but later on we're going to see case law developing on the consequences of using cloud technologies to do traditional business functions that might have been done within a corporate entity or a government entity. And other than that, I don't know that there's anything really out there immediately I would be looking for, other than there's an en banc decision from the Third Circuit expected in a little while, and it really addresses the rights of students under the First Amendment. So it's going to have limited application, I would assume, outside the First Amendment area. But it's whether or not students can be disciplined for putting things on Facebook. Now, that's obviously a social media issue. It's got First Amendment issue because we're talking about public schools, but I'm looking forward to that. That was argued a little while ago, and I obviously have no clue when these decisions coming out, but I think that's going to be interesting when we see that.
Okay. Well, thank you, Farrah, Jennifer, and Ron, for joining us on another show. It's been a pleasure to have you share your knowledge with us and our listeners. Hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. And also, now that the podcast is done, I wish both Jennifer and Farrah speedy conclusions to your pregnancies and healthy children. And please let us know if you pick an e-discovery name for your kids. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com for a complete list of our shows. You can also remember our show and website phonetically as Easy Bytes, which is what it sounds like, of ESI information. However you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI Bytes you back. This is Carl Schinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Jurnov, wishing you a nice day.